Welcome to NTD Evening News. Our top story tonight, no impeachment trial for DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Senate Democrats have dismissed both articles of impeachment against him. Luis Martinez has more on the historic impeachment effort from Capitol Hill. House Speaker Mike Johnson today moving forward with foreign aid bills worth billions of dollars, but they are not tied to any border funding. The backlash he's now facing from within his own party. Israel facing pressure from Germany and the UK, what international leaders discussed at a meeting about Israel's response to Iran's recent attack. That says over a dozen IDF soldiers and some civilians are injured in an attack by Hezbollah. Who is tougher on China? President Biden now calling for tripling tariffs on Chinese steel, a policy first imposed under President Trump. What that means for American manufacturing and the 2024 presidential race. Iris Tao at the White House. In just 2 days, attorneys in the Trump criminal trial have selected the first seven jurors. Who are they? And what is Trump's reaction to the process? Arlene Richards reports.
This is NTD Evening News, live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City. Here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. The Senate today dismissing both articles of impeachment against Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas. Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has more from Capitol Hill.
Around 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, Senator Patty Murray, the Democrat from Washington, was sworn in as the president pro tempore of the Senate. Minutes later, all 100 U.S. senators in groups of four were sworn in as jurors, and the Senate became an impeachment court. Soon after, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, as expected, put a motion to dismiss both articles of impeachment. During the vote to dismiss the first article of impeachment, Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, was the only one not to vote along party lines. She voted present. Everyone else, every other U.S. senator, voted according to party lines. Minutes after the vote in the Senate to dismiss both articles of impeachment, Speaker Mike Johnson took to social media and spoke to the press to call the Senate vote a shameless act and a dereliction of duty. Let's listen to what Speaker Mike Johnson had to say about this.
The idea that the Senate and under Chuck Schumer's leadership voted on party lines to not even allow the American people to evaluate the evidence is shameful. I think it's a violation of their constitutional responsibility. And I think there'll be a reckoning for all this in the election cycle in the fall.
So Speaker Mike Johnson is referring to the Senate not picking up its duty to hold a full trial. It'll be the first time in U.S. history that the Senate does not hold a full trial for impeachment, for the exception of four other occasions that were very exceptional. On three of those four occasions, it was because the government official that was impeached had either died, resigned, or was no longer in office. And in the fourth exceptional case was a government official that was being impeached was a U.S. senator, and the Senate decided it did not have the jurisdiction to try one of its own and instead decided to expel the U.S. senator. So history made this Wednesday with the Senate vote and the dismissal of both articles of impeachment against Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas.
Some House Republicans today strongly criticizing Speaker Mike Johnson. That's after he announced he will move forward with foreign aid bills, but no border funding. NTD's Dave Martin has more.
House GOP leadership introduced a set of foreign aid bills on Wednesday. It includes over $60 billion for Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, and $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific, which includes Taiwan. However, it doesn't include any funding for the U.S.-Mexico border. That's despite the fact that Speaker Mike Johnson previously indicated he'd support foreign aid only if it were tied to border funding. Instead, the House is expected to introduce a separate border bill, the text of which is scheduled to be released late Wednesday. The most conservative House Republicans now say they're not happy with Johnson's decision. Representative Eric Burleson fears a vote on a separate bill won't get anywhere, saying if we want to force the Senate to consider a border security bill, then it must be included in the aid bill. Congressman Bob Good points out that the bill includes $300 million proposed for border police in Ukraine, nothing for the U.S. border. Matt Gaetz commented on that, saying, "Any Republican who votes to proceed onto this Ukraine bill with our border wide open is part of the invasion." Meanwhile, in New York City, a clip from a Tuesday committee hearing is being shared online. It shows an immigrant criticizing the situation at a New York City shelter.
"At the shelter, the food, my kids cannot eat the food at the shelter. And on Ramadan time, we couldn't eat because when you come back for the breaks, the food is no good at all."
The city held the hearing to probe whether black illegal immigrants are treated unfairly in the Big Apple. This is Dave Martin for NTD News.
President Biden is now endorsing the foreign aid bills from Speaker Johnson and says he would sign it immediately if passed. The final totals for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan are basically in line with the Senate's earlier proposal. The aid to Israel is split between both military and humanitarian concerns in the region. A fourth bill is expected to include a revised TikTok ban, which passed the House but has stalled in the Senate. It's also expected to include the Repo Act that would allow the U.S. to pay for some foreign aid by seizing the assets of Russian oligarchs. Johnson said the House will vote on the three current bills on Saturday, despite some resistance from GOP members. We have more updates on the conflicts in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with the foreign ministers of Germany and the UK in Jerusalem earlier today.
UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron and German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock visited Jerusalem to meet with top Israeli officials on Wednesday. This comes as Israel weighs its response to Iran's aerial attack over the weekend.
"The situation is very concerning. It's right to show solidarity with Israel. It's right to have made our views clear about what should happen next, but it's clear the Israelis are making a decision to act. We hope they do so in a way that does as little to escalate this as possible, and in a way that, as I said yesterday, is smart as well as tough."
Israel, with help from the U.S., the U.K., and other allies, successfully intercepted nearly all the missiles and drones from Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this about Israel's response.
"I thank our friends for their support in the defense of Israel, and I say this, both support in words and support in actions. They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice. I appreciate it, but I want to make it clear, we will make our own decisions, and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself."
Cameron and Baerbock both urged restraint during the meeting. World leaders are urging Israel not to retaliate against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran is warning that even the tiniest invasion of its territory would bring a massive and harsh response. Cameron stressed the need to refocus discussions on the Israel-Hamas war, back to hostages and humanitarian aid. He also called for G7 sanctions on Iran. A G7 foreign ministers meeting is currently underway in Italy. And back in the U.S., the Biden administration said it will also impose sanctions on Iran, saying the new sanctions will target Iran's missile and drone program and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard in the coming days. This came as the House passed its second batch of measures to combat the Iranian threat, including seven bills and two resolutions. Israel on Wednesday reported that 14 soldiers and four civilians were injured by drones and missiles from Hezbollah near the Lebanese border. Reporting by Allison Lee, NTD News.
President Biden seeking higher tariffs on Chinese steel. That's in a bid to compete with former President Trump on being tough on the communist regime. NTD's White House correspondent Iris Tao has the details.
And President Biden on Wednesday called for tripling tariffs on Chinese steel, raising it from 7.5% to 25%. Biden says that's to combat China's practices of cheating and flooding U.S. markets with cheap imports that hurt American workers and companies.
"They're not competing. They're cheating. They're cheating. And we've seen the damage here in America. If that investment confirms these anti-competitive trade practices, then I'm calling on her to consider tripling the tariff rates for both steel imports and aluminum imports from China."
Biden says Chinese imports are cheap only because the Chinese government is unfairly subsidizing them. Biden also mentions how back in the early 2000s, a flood of Chinese cheap imports caused many Americans to lose their jobs. Biden vowed to not let that happen again. Meanwhile, the new push from the Biden administration to crack down on China's unfair trade practices comes as Biden's trying to appeal to working-class voters. He's on a three-day campaign swing to the battleground state of Pennsylvania, a key base for the U.S. steel industry. Meanwhile, the higher tariffs on Chinese steel were initially imposed during the Trump administration. Trump himself has also vowed to impose even tougher tariffs on not only Chinese goods, but also goods from other countries, but especially on Chinese imports if he gets reelected. But President Biden on Wednesday taking aim at Trump's approach.
We're standing up against Chinese government unfair economic practices and industrial overcapacity. Meanwhile, my predecessor and the MAGA Republicans want across-the-board tariffs on all imports from all countries that could badly hurt American consumers.
And Trump's campaign, meanwhile, responded to Biden's call today, saying that, quote, the Biden campaign is attacking President Trump's effective tariffs on China, while the Biden White House is planning to implement similar tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. So we can see both candidates now really trying to compete to become the tougher on China candidate in this election. Reporting from the White House, Iris Howe, NTD News.
Trump is complaining about the number of jurors his team gets to veto, just 10, and they've already used up 6, but so has the prosecution. Jury selection continues on Thursday. For now, 7 jurors total are seated. NTD's legal correspondent Arlene Richards reports on what we know so far about the selected jurors.
7 jurors were seated on the second day of the so-called hush money trial in Manhattan. In the coming days, these 4 men and 3 women will be joined by 5 more New Yorkers to decide the fate of former President Trump. Prosecutors accused Trump of falsifying business records to cover up a payment made to a former adult film actress who he allegedly had an affair with, to buy her silence during his 2016 run for president. In the week before the trial, Trump's attorneys made several attempts to delay it. They argued that the majority of New Yorkers already think the former president is guilty. Because of that concern, jury selection was expected to take at least 2 weeks. But now, with more than half the jury selected, Judge Juan Merchan is hoping to finish by the end of this week. So who are the jurors? Juror number 1 is a middle-aged salesman from Ireland. He will serve as the case's foreman. He works in sales and has some college education. He gets his news from the New York Times, Daily Mail, Fox News, and MSNBC. He said he heard about some of Trump's other cases. Juror number 2 is an oncology nurse and a native New Yorker. She gets her news from the New York Times, CNN, Google, and Facebook. She said she didn't have an opinion about Trump. Juror number 3 is a corporate attorney originally from Oregon. He gets his news from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Google. He said he wasn't very familiar with all of the charges against Trump in this case. Juror number 4 is a self-employed IT consultant originally from Puerto Rico. He's lived in the Lower East Side for 40 years. He gets his news from the Daily News, the New York Times, and Google. He said he finds Trump fascinating and mysterious. Juror number 5 is a young English teacher with a master's degree in education. She gets her news from Google and TikTok, but said she doesn't really care for the news. She is the only juror who wasn't aware of Trump's other criminal cases. Juror number 6 is a recent college graduate working as a software engineer for the Walt Disney Company. She gets her news from the New York Times, Google, Facebook, and TikTok. She said she will be fair and impartial. Finally, juror number 7 is an attorney living in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He gets his news from the New York Times, the New York Post, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. He said he had no personal opinions about Trump. With over half of the jurors picked by the second day of trial, Trump complained Wednesday about not getting unlimited chances to reject prospective jurors. New York state law only permits 10 strikes in lower-class felony cases. Trump said on Truth Social that the 10 was not nearly enough when we were purposely given the second worst venue in the country. Both the prosecution and the defense have used 6 of their 10 strikes. Arlene Richards, NTD News.
And in a filing today, the prosecution says if the former president takes the stand, they will ask him about the recent verdicts against him, including the civil fraud trial and the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial. These cases and others could be used to discredit Trump if Judge Juan Merchan approves it. The judge said he'll allow the parties to debate the matter on Friday if jury selection is completed. Coming up, a senior editor at NPR has resigned from the outlet. This comes after he published an essay criticizing the network for liberal bias. That says NPR's new CEO is facing backlash over her comments on the First Amendment and former President Trump. Lawmakers grill the president of Columbia University over anti-Semitism on campus, hear her testimony before Congress. And Boeing is facing scrutiny from lawmakers as whistleblowers criticize the company's safety culture. Hear why one whistleblower says every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. A senior business editor at NPR has announced his resignation. This comes just a day after the outlet suspended him for an essay criticizing what he called the company's liberal bias. In a statement on X, Uri Berliner took jabs at the company's CEO. Berliner said he can't work in a newsroom where he is, quote, disparaged by his boss. Just days prior, he published an article on the Free Press titled, "I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust." In it, he said NPR's culture had changed from having an open-minded spirit to a much narrower worldview. Berliner cited a number of examples in NPR's coverage, from Hunter Biden's business dealings to the Israel-Hamas war, specifically, quote, highlighting the suffering of Palestinians at almost every turn while downplaying the atrocities of October 7th. NPR CEO Catherine Maher has defended the outlet. She's been criticized for an alleged progressive bias and for disparaging social media posts about Trump. Prior to being fired at NPR, she had said, quote, "Our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done," unquote. Joining me now to discuss the latest controversy over National Public Radio is investigative journalist Jeff Carlson. Jeff is also the co-host of Truth Over News on Epic TV. Jeff Carlson, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Recently, this clip of NPR CEO Catherine Maher, which was discovered by conservative activist Christopher Rufo, is making the rounds, especially today, with even Elon Musk commenting on it. This is what she had to say about her fight against, quote, disinformation.
The number one challenge here that we see and is, of course, the First Amendment in the United States. It also means that it is a little bit tricky to really address some of the real challenges of where does bad information come from and sort of the influence peddlers who have made a real market economy around it.
Jeff, what is your reaction to this statement by the CEO of NPR?
Well, it just keeps getting worse, doesn't it? You know, this whole thing originated with the essay by Uri Berliner, one of the editors there who was frustrated with the environment that he was working on. It kind of finally blew the lid off. And then as people started digging on the CEO, the more they found, the more alarming it was. And what I think is going on here and why we're seeing the kind of, you know, reaction that we're seeing is this is exposing the whole side of censorship and the so-called disinformation experts. You know, she's made a number of speeches, you know, one of which she was bragging about working with the government and censorship efforts. And now here she's talking about the single biggest impediment to her work is the First Amendment.
There are now growing calls to defund NPR, with Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn telling Fox News that she's planning to propose legislative action that would threaten to cut the funding to NPR. What is NPR's record when it comes to covering major political stories?
Well, you know, it's I guess in many ways it's like a lot of other news organizations in that they've got kind of a storied history and had done a great job. But as our environment became more politicized, so did they. And, you know, the funding is something that we've talked about for a long time. A lot of people have talked about it for a long time, and it's not a small number. I believe the parent organization gets almost $500 million, like $500 million. The radios get something on the magnitude of $125 million. So we're not talking about small amounts, even though NPR likes to portray it that way. And I would remind everybody, you know, if you want to point to a time when a change really happened, it was earlier than this, but NPR actually came out at the time of the Biden-Trump, you know, when they were running for president. And in late October, right before the actual election itself, they said that they weren't going to cover the Hunter Biden laptop story because it wasn't newsworthy, and made a public statement about that. And they knew it was perfectly newsworthy. They knew that the FBI had possession of Hunter's laptop. They knew in real time that it was a real story. Publicly, they denigrated it. And that's one of the elements that may have helped swing that election.
Now, the NPR whistleblower has resigned today following his essay that criticized the broadcaster's liberal slant. He revealed that there were 87 registered Democrats working in editorial positions at their Washington, D.C. office for NPR and zero Republicans. Now, what is the significance of all of this coming to light now, especially given the diminishing and dwindling public trust in media?
Well, first of all, I'd note that's exactly the same composition of the ideological makeup at our DOJ right now. But I think this story has larger elements. And it's important to note, you know, again, this whole disinformation angle and what is the truth. And her admission that the truth itself isn't so important, that it's not relevant. And, you know, I saw James Lindsay put out something today where he said, you know, the difference, that really is the difference. It's not as much left or right, but it's rather people who want the truth and people who want to create the truth, if you will. And that's what has been encapsulating the entirety of the media complex. They create what the truth is. That's why we have disinformation experts. Those people ostensibly are the ones that are deciding what truth is. And yet they're the people that lied about COVID, they lied about Russia collusion, they lied about Ukraine. So, you know, these disinformation, misinformation experts, their entire job is to fabricate the truth. And I think that's why this story is resonating with people. Everything that they've witnessed over the last several years is sort of encapsulated by this story. And they're seeing it in real time. They're seeing her quotes juxtaposed against the way they reported.
Expanding on that, what is the concern or the risk of having a publicly funded news service that is heavily biased towards one political party?
Well, you know, I mean, what's the role of the news fundamentally? The role of the news is to report on the government, right? It is supposed to be an adversarial relationship by its very definition. It is not supposed to be friendly or comfortable or conversational. And, you know, yet with receiving a large chunk of their funding from the government, they're now reliant on the government. So that alters the fundamental nature of the relationship. But, you know, we can also extend these problems, these relationship problems, to all the other media organizations. New York Times, Washington Post have very, very cozy relationships with their national security counterparts. So we've moved away from this watchdog, the press as a watchdog on the government, into a role of cooperation with the government, which is the very reason that we saw all the censorship actions that we've seen over the last number of years. It's a partnership. It is not an adversarial watchdog relationship. That's ended many years ago, unfortunately.
And give us a sense, just how widespread is this activism journalism, if you will? How do we get back to the watchdog stage that you're talking about?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we can get back under the old model. The pervasiveness of the activism is so widespread. It's endemic. It's at every major institution, and I don't see any rectification for it. But people are waking up to the fact that they're constantly being lied to. It's why the industry is undergoing such profound and fundamental changes. We've seen any number of closures, bankruptcies, etc. And it is opening up an entirely new realm of, you know, sort of the new media, people that are doing their podcasts, you know, you folks at Epic that are looking for the fundamental truth, just want to report the news. People are hungry for that. So while it's a very deep and fundamental problem on the one hand, on the other, it also creates an opening and people are looking for that opening. So it's an opportunity as well. But I don't think you fix the old media. The old media is going to go away.
Jeff Carlson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Leaders from Columbia University testified before Congress today on the school's response to anti-Semitism on campus. University President Manoush Shafiq said she's committed to confronting anti-Semitism.
I've held on to four principles. First, safety is paramount, and we would do whatever is necessary to ensure the safety of our campus. Because of those efforts, the vast majority of our demonstrations have been peaceful. Second, we would demonstrate care and compassion equally to everyone. Third, we must uphold freedom of speech because it's essential to our academic mission, but we cannot and shouldn't tolerate abuse of this privilege to harass and discriminate. And fourth, the ultimate answer to anti-Semitism and all its forms is education.
During today's hearing of the House Education Committee, Chairwoman Virginia Fox appeared with Jewish students from Columbia who said they have faced threats and physical confrontation. Lawmakers pressed Shafiq over Columbia professors who praised the Hamas terrorist group. They include Professor Joseph Massad, who allegedly called the October 7th massacre awesome, and Professor Mohammed Abdu, who allegedly expressed support for Hamas on social media. Shafiq said that Mossad is under investigation and that the university will fire Abdu. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik said Republicans would hold Columbia accountable for failing to protect students. Meanwhile, the University of Southern California is also under scrutiny this week. It canceled a graduation speech by a pro-Palestinian valedictorian due to security concerns. Scathing testimony delivered by Boeing whistleblowers today. They say Boeing effectively produces defective planes and everyone who gets into one is at risk. NTD's Virginia Gibson has more.
Every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk.
Boeing whistleblowers give scathing testimony on Boeing's safety culture. Engineer Sam Salapour says it's effectively putting out defective airplanes.
The company is taking manufacturing shortcuts on the 787 program that may significantly reduce the airplane safety. Serious issues on the 787 program, not properly closing thousands of gaps in its assembly of the fuselage on major joints.
A culture of retaliation prevents workers like him from reporting these problems. His boss even suggested he'd kill someone who said what Salapour said about plane quality. In another instance, he found a nail stuck into the tire of his car.
It really scares me, believe me, but I am at peace. You know, if something happens to me, I am at peace because I feel like by coming forward, I will be saving a lot of lives. And I'm at peace. Whatever happens, it happens.
Whistleblowers assert that Boeing prioritizes profits over safety. This comes after the door blew off of a Boeing plane mid-flight earlier this year and various other incidents.
Engine anti-ice exhaust duct fasteners, compromised sealant adhesion within the center fuel tank, loose bolts in the rudder assembly, stuck rudder pedals, misinstalled electrical wire bundles in the wing spoilers, and then, of course, the door blowout.
Former FAA engineer Joe Jacobson saw serious flaws with Boeing's planes. He observed Boeing hiding these flaws from government agencies. Former Boeing manager Ed Pearson says even the government agencies have done a poor job.
These agencies have become lazy, complacent, and reactive. The deterioration has been occurring over several years.
Pearson says the National Transportation Safety Board, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Department of Transportation all ignored Boeing's problems, even after multiple high-profile crashes.
If the leaders of those government agencies had done their jobs, investigators would have uncovered a mountain of important information. The FAA would have known Boeing's production processes were a mess.
The whistleblowers want to change Boeing's entire production system, one that encourages people to raise issues and prioritize safety over profits. Virginia Gibson, NTD News.
Coming up, what challenges does House Speaker Mike Johnson face as he unveils foreign aid bills? A former official in international affairs joins us to discuss the debate. And the House Oversight Committee is investigating the Chinese regime's infiltration of the United States. Jack Bradley is in D.C. with the latest on that probe after the break. Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some of today's top headlines. Seven jurors have been selected for former President Trump's hush money trial in New York. The judge said he hopes to finish jury selection by the end of this week. And Trump complained about not getting unlimited chances to reject prospective jurors. The Senate dismissed both articles of impeachment against Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas and ended the trial. Senate Democrats argued that the articles were unconstitutional, while Republicans argued for a full trial. President Biden called for tripling tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum imports at a campaign stop in Pittsburgh. Biden said this is to combat China's practices that hurt American workers and companies. Foreign ministers of Germany and the UK visited Jerusalem and met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The diplomats urged restraint, while Netanyahu said Israel will make its own decisions on retaliation against Iran. The House will be voting on three separate foreign aid bills, with $61 billion to Ukraine, $26 billion to Israel, and $8 billion to Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. Biden endorsed the bills and said he would sign them immediately if passed, while House GOP pushed back on the lack of border measures. Joining me now to analyze the debate over those foreign aid bills in Congress is Bart Marcois. He's a former presidential campaign policy advisor and former Energy Department official for international affairs. Bart, thanks for joining us. What do you see as the reasons behind this shift in the House GOP when it comes to foreign aid? Not long ago, the calls were to stop funding foreign issues and to focus on America. What changed?
Good evening, Tiffany. I think what changes the seriousness of the situations overseas. When you're dealing with foreign affairs, if you're just dealing with the standard issue diplomacy, you've got a lot of room to move around. But when you're down to actual fighting wars on the ground, you don't have room for error. And in those three parts of the world, Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, we're dangerously close to a huge conflagration. And I think everybody is suddenly now getting serious and saying, you know what, we need to send artillery shells to Ukraine. We need to fund their special operations, their military special operations command. We need to replenish the Iron Dome rockets, and we need to make sure that Taiwan is as bristling as it can be with weapons and ammunition to deter any Chinese aggression there.
Now, we've also seen President Trump or former President Trump signaling his support for additional Ukraine aid if it's in the form of a loan. How much do those factors, plus it being an election year, play into what we are seeing now in terms of growing support for foreign aid?
I think Trump is signaling that he is he's giving permission to his best friends in the House and his supporters in the House to go along with this aid package. I think it's good policy to make it in the form of a loan. Ukraine is a wealthy country. It will be a wealthy country again when it's at peace. And there's no reason it can't repay a loan. So it's good policy. And he's saying, don't fall on your swords over this. Go ahead and vote to increase aid to Ukraine. And here is a face-saving way to do that.
Now, in terms of the House, the current House majority is the slimmest in modern history, with Speaker Mike Johnson facing a motion to vacate within his own party. What does this mean for Congress?
Well, it means there's no room for error. If Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, follows through on her threat to file a motion to vacate and Thomas Massie seconds it, well, then there's not enough Republican votes to keep Speaker Mike Johnson in the chair. He would have to make a deal with the Democrats, and then he would be a wounded speaker. He would be there because of Democrat help, and that would lessen his effectiveness. But I don't think that she's going to do that. I think Trump is signaling to her publicly, don't do it. He is probably communicating to her privately, don't do it. Go ahead and make a big fuss, get attention, get concessions. But in the end, nobody wants to vacate the chair. There is nobody waiting in the wings to take Mike Johnson's place. They need to have him there, and they need some continuity. It's an election year. They don't want to present a mess to the voters just when they're starting to pay attention.
Expanding on that last part, if Johnson does get ousted as House Speaker, who is even left to take up the gavel? Some names being floated include House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, who ran unsuccessfully in October. You know, where does this leave the House? Who's left?
Yeah, Tom Emmer was unsuccessful in October because he was shot down within hours, I think, by President Trump, saying, I don't like the guy. Well, now he and President Trump have made nice, and he's Trump's chairman for his home state, and he's backing Trump, and Trump is backing him for reelection. But there's also Jim Jordan, there's also Steve Scalise. There are several names that are out there that could do a good job. I think Jim Jordan would be a consensus candidate, but nobody has enough votes to really make it happen, and they're not going to do again what they did earlier and vacate it before they have a new speaker. They're not going to go rudderless. So until there's a chosen speaker in the wings who has all the votes locked down, they're not going to kick out Mike Johnson, and they don't have that chosen speaker.
Bart Marcois, former presidential campaign policy advisor and former Energy Department official for international affairs, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tiffany. Good night.
Lawmakers are probing the Chinese Communist Party's harmful influence on America. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley brings us more from the first of several hearings by the House Oversight Committee.
The House Oversight Committee has launched an investigation into the Chinese regime's harmful influence here in the U.S. The goal is to expose and stop what they call the Chinese regime's political warfare campaign. Members of Congress and a panel of experts dove into areas like education, where the Chinese Communist Party has set up so-called Confucius schools and institutes, from preschool to college, to spread the party's propaganda and praise communism. Other topics included the Chinese regime's attempts to sabotage American agriculture, technology, and business, even going so far as to threaten the Chinese diaspora.
There's transnational repression occurring. We had a hearing with regard to that issue where they're going after dissidents, they're going after critics of the regime. They're going after Tibetans and Uyghurs and other minorities, Hong Kongers who live in the U.S.
For years, China, or CCP, China, you know, has pretended to be our friend, all the while undermining every institution we have.
Shenyun Performing Arts has long been the target of the Chinese regime because it displays what China was like before communism. And many of the performers practice Falun Gong, a spiritual discipline based on truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance, which is persecuted by the Chinese regime.
Theaters received emails threatening mass shootings and bombings if they refused to cancel Xianyang performances. Xianyang has reported multiple instances where the tires of their tour buses have been slashed.
They are frankly criminal acts by a foreign government against our people on our soil. This is something that has to be prioritized with a response in the bilateral relationship with the PRC rather than a shoulder shrug or something that we can quietly say that we talked about later.
Uses our own media. One good example is its attack on the Falun Gong. It's basically convinced the entire academic university system in the United States that they are a brainwashed cult. They've done the same thing to our media institutions. And so, you know, that is the way they do it, is by controlling our own narratives within the
United States. Saying that they're not a brainwashed cult.
I think they're just a group of people that are dissidents of the Chinese communist regime.
Yeah, I agree with you too. They put on a pretty cool dance routine. It's pretty cool.
The committee says it will continue to expose and combat the threats that the Chinese regime poses to U.S. national security. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
Why was the National Guard's response to the January 6th Capitol breach delayed? Whistleblowers from the D.C. National Guard today testified about the delay before a House committee.
What I can tell you with absolute certainty is that we had a force equipped and ready to respond. And despite the inaccuracies of the DODIG report, we had a plan and would have liked the opportunity to try. Instead, we waited for hours, less than 2 miles east of the Capitol, knowing our Capitol had been breached and not understanding why we had not received the authorization to respond.
Generals Piatt and Flynn have lied to Congress, to federal investigators, and to the American people about why it took so long for the District of Columbia National Guard to deploy to the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Their distortions contributed to a deeply and fundamentally flawed Department of Defense Inspector General investigation and to deficiencies in other official inquiries.
Four whistleblowers from the D.C. Army National Guard who were on duty on January 6, 2021, testified before the House Administration Committee. They told lawmakers that they dispute the Pentagon Inspector General's report on the National Guard's response. That report determined that military officials did not delay the Pentagon's response to the Capitol breach and that the department acted appropriately that day. The whistleblowers said that the report was inaccurate, biased, and flawed, and that it tried to shield some officials from responsibility. Coming up in the NBA, a player is banned for life as part of a gambling investigation. Dave Martin joins us to explain when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, plenty to discuss, but let's begin in the NBA, where the league has banned Toronto center Jontay Porter for gambling violations. What did the NBA find that led to this?
Well, reportedly, he revealed confidential information to bettors, limited his participation in at least two contests, and bet on some games, some NBA games, but that was actually while he was in the G League, which is actually the NBA's minor league system. Now, this investigation started in March, actually, after some betting sites noticed some irregular betting on the over-under for his individual statistics in two of his games. But in both of those games, he just happened to exit early too, which ensured whoever bet the under would win. Now, the league found that he revealed information about his health to a known sports bettor ahead of a March 20 game against the Sacramento Kings. Now, another bettor then got that information and placed an $80,000 parlay bet, which is really just a riskier series of bets put together that featured the unders on his personal statistics. Porter then left that game as well with an illness after just 3 minutes, accumulating no statistics. Now, a similar situation actually happened in January, too. Porter played just 4 minutes here before exiting with an existing injury. And in that game, there was also a similar amount of bets placed on the unders for his stats. Now, getting banned usually means forever. I mean, the league didn't actually specify, but if they think someone is sacrificing the integrity of the game, that usually draws the biggest punishment. Now, there's actually been no comment from Jontay Porter yet, though.
Well, in women's basketball, WNBA rookie Caitlin Clark's $75,000 salary has sparked debate over unfair gender pay. What are some of the main arguments on both sides?
Well, of course, it's a very delicate subject to many people because I'm sure gender pay, the gap has been going on in different industries for a while. It's easy to look at the average NBA player salary of just over $10 million and compare that to the WNBA average salary of just $150,000 and say there's a gender pay disparity. The common argument I see is that the women work just as hard, which I have no doubt is true. On the other side, basketball is actually entertainment. I mean, this isn't an assembly line process or something. I mean, putting a ball through a hoop doesn't actually create a product or anything. It can draw a crowd. So, of course, revenue is decided by supply in demand. And of course, you don't pay to see some unknown comedian versus what you'd pay to see, like, you know, Dave Chappelle or Jerry Seinfeld, of course. And it's not like the reason there's a separate men's league either is because men and women can't play together or something. The NBA has allowed plenty of women actually to try out. Now, in addition to that, each league is really their own business, generates their own revenue. Now, the WNBA is young. They've only been around for 27 years. They're not as financially successful as the NBA. They've been around 75 years. I think something tells me, though, that this is going to change with Caitlin Clark joining the league.
Well, shifting gears to hockey, tonight is the last regular season game for a pair of NFL players in pursuit of some lofty goals. What milestones could be achieved tonight?
Yeah, there's two big ones, both in the same game between Toronto and Tampa Bay tonight. First, Auston Matthews of Toronto, he's trying to go for his 70th goal of the season. No one's done that since 1993. That was Alexander Mogilny and Timo Soloni, both had 76. In fact, it's only been done 14 times in the nearly 100-year history of the NHL. Like half those times were by Mario Lemieux or Wayne Gretzky. Also, Nikita Kucherov, is one assist away from 100 on the season. That's only been done 14 times as well, including this season, actually, where the Oilers' Connor McDavid is already at 100 right now. Now, this is a very exclusive list, too. You've got Wayne Gretzky, who actually did 11 of those 14 times, plus Bobby Orr, Mario Lemieux, and, as I just mentioned, Connor McDavid. They each did it once. Now, McDavid is also playing tonight. His Oilers will play at the Coyotes. They'll also play tomorrow night, though, which is the final day of the NHL's regular season.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tiff.
And that is all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.